Welcome to the Emergency Medicine Cases Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Anton Hellman, bringing you the brightest minds in emergency medicine from around the world. EM Cases is brought to you by SHREMI, the Schwartz-Reisman Emergency Medicine Institute. That's a nonprofit organization dedicated to improving EM care through high-quality research and education.
The opinions expressed on this podcast are intended for information and education purposes only and should not be used to diagnose, treat, or prevent any medical condition, nor should they be used as a substitute for medical advice from a qualified practicing physician.
This episode is brought to you by Easy Recess, the resuscitation assistant. This amazing app has drug dosing, equipment size calculation, treatment algorithms, all in under 3 clicks. Rapid access to life-saving critical info in a user-friendly interface. Try the app for free with the promo code EMCases or visit easyrecess.com/EMCases. That's easyrecess.com/EMCases. We'd like to think that we're getting better at identifying acute heart failure and making good disposition decisions, but the facts are ED physicians are only about 80% accurate at diagnosing acute heart failure. And 30-day mortality outcomes and readmission rates for acute heart failure have been about the same in North America for the last few decades in a row. Plus, we often send home patients who should be admitted and admit patients who should be sent home. This is because there are many challenges for EM docs when it comes to heart failure. First, the diagnosis can be tough and often is only made once the patient is admitted. There is no one clinical feature that's a slam dunk for the diagnosis, and even combinations of features are not so great. Plus, there are many flavors of heart failure. There's diastolic heart failure, systolic heart failure, right-sided, left-sided, scape, cardiogenic shock, just to complicate things a bit further. And even if we've made an accurate diagnosis, the decision of whether to admit or send home can be very challenging. We have risk stratification decision scales to help, but A, are they good enough? B, are we using them appropriately? And C, are they any better than Gestalt? In this podcast, with the help of Dr. Doug Lee, cardiologist and researcher at Sunnybrook Hospital and at University Health Network in Toronto, and Dr. Claire Atsema, who you've probably heard before on EM Cases, our go-to EM atrial fibrillation expert, an EM doc and researcher also from Sunnybrook Hospital, we'll dig into how to improve our diagnostic accuracy of acute heart failure in the ED and how to improve our disposition decision-making so that just the right number of people are admitted and just the right number of people are safely sent home. Welcome, Dr. Lee and Dr. Atsema.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Before we dive in, any conflicts of interest to declare? Dr. Lee?
I'm the developer of the Emerge score, but I have no financial benefits from being its developer.
You haven't made $100 billion from being a researcher?
I've made exactly 0 cents from it, so not quite yet.
All right. And Dr. Atsema, any conflicts of interest to declare?
Nada.
All right. I want to dive into the test characteristics of the history and physical exam findings in acute heart failure. Now, given that we aren't great at nailing the diagnosis of heart failure in the first place, like I said, we only have a hit rate of about 80%. I think it's important to really dig into how good the different historical and physical exam findings are in the diagnosis. So Dr. Atsema, what are some of the test characteristics of, say, PND or orthopnea or ankle swelling in the diagnosis of acute heart failure? And how should we use these numbers to inform our decisions around disposition?
Well, like you alluded to earlier, no single symptom or sign has perfect sensitivity or specificity for the diagnosis. So we have to cull together the best of them in order to make the clinical diagnosis and then use our tests to try and confirm that diagnosis. Specifically for symptoms, the best, most sensitive finding is shortness of breath on exertion. But again, just because they have it, the specificity is poor. So that means it could still be something else, even if they have it. And the most specific finding is PND and orthopnea. On exam, the most specific finding is an S3, believe it or not, has a very, very high specificity. But how good are we at diagnosing an S3? Looking at inter-rater reliability between perhaps you and me, I don't have much faith that I can reliably hear an S3. So that's a bit of a disadvantage. JVD is also pretty good. But again, I'm not sure that everyone is that good at seeing an elevated jugular venous pressure. Edema is pretty good at about 78% specificity. So that's something we can use. And we all like to listen for RALS. I certainly do that when I'm examining a patient with CHF, but it only has about a 60% sensitivity. So even if they don't have RALS, there's still a 40% chance they still have heart failure. So none of them are great, unfortunately.
Okay, so the ones that are maybe better than we might have thought, PND and orthopnea are pretty good. Shortness of breath on exertion are pretty good. Edema, okay.
S3 and JVD, if you're sure.
Right. So we should try and improve our physical exam skills as much as we possibly can. I will endeavor to listen more carefully for S3, even though it seems like most of us have just completely forgotten about getting an S3. When we look at the natural history of heart failure, we know that typically these patients get acutely sick, come to the hospital, get treated, and then get almost back to baseline, but not quite. And then this happens repeatedly so that over the long haul, they gradually get worse and worse and worse and eventually die. So that's kind of, if you think about the pattern of when these patients go home, they're a little bit better than they were before, but not quite as good. And so we should expect a certain number of bounce backs and bad outcomes for our heart failure patients. Now, before we get to the decision tools to help us with the heart failure disposition, let's talk some numbers. So Dr. Atsuma, when we send a patient home from the ED with a diagnosis of heart failure, what are the outcomes in terms of mortality, morbidity, and bounce backs? And I think it'll be interesting to know what the difference is between Canada and the US, because my understanding is that we sort of over-admit in the US, and in Canada, we under-admit.
Exactly. So in the US, they admit 80 to 90% of their heart failure patients from the ED, whereas in Canada, it's only between 40 and 60%, so a lot lower. And around 10% of the patients whom we discharge from the ED are going to be returning to the ED within 2 weeks to be admitted. So that's certainly concerning. I actually ran some numbers a long time ago, this is well over a decade ago, using my access to ICES data, just looking at ED heart failure patients who are discharged. And I found that there was a just under 4% mortality at 30 days. And at a year, it was 23%. And that really opened my eyes. Like, these are pretty sick patients. That's actually similar to mortality rates as cancer. And we get all riled up about cancer mortality, and yet heart failure patients, not so much. So it definitely gave me pause when I'm dispositioning a patient with heart failure from the ED. Now, that said, I strongly believe that this information needs to be disseminated not just to emergency physicians, but also to our admitting teams in the hospitals, who, in my experience, often balk or push back at admitting a patient who doesn't have, you know, obvious shortness of breath that hasn't resolved with diuresis, or even after we've diuresed someone, sometimes they still need to come in. So I really think we all need to be on the same team here and acknowledging that these are pretty sick patients who often do need to come in.
Wow. So that's an incredible number, a 4% mortality at 30 days. Let's keep that number in mind as we go through the rest of the podcast here. 4% mortality in 30 days. So that brings up, what would be the acceptable risk? So, you know, again, given this natural history of heart failure that we just discussed and the 4% 30-day mortality when we do discharge patients home from the ED, Dr. Lee, what do you think should be the acceptable event rate for mortality and bounce backs?
Well, in all comers, the 7-day mortality rate, the median 7-day mortality rate is about 2%. So obviously, the lower we can get, the better it is. I would estimate that about approximately 0.5% mortality at 7 days might be a reasonable target. That means for every 200 patients that we see in the eMERGE, there might be one death. For 30 days, I think a reasonable target that we should be aiming for is 1%, perhaps 2%. In terms of readmissions and bounce backs, I think less than 15% is fairly reasonable.
Okay, so I think that's good to know what our goals are for these patients. So really, we want a goal of about 0.5% 7-day mortality, 1% 30-day mortality, which is consistent with our ACS patients in terms of, you know, MACE from the heart score, for example. 1% seems to be a pretty standard. And right now, currently in Canada, we're over that. So we have some work to do. Now let's get into talking about the various heart failure risk stratification scales and disposition tools. Now there are 8 of these that I could find on the internet. But in the spirit of evidence-based medicine, we'll limit our discussion to the only 3 that have been validated. There's the Ottawa Heart Failure Risk Score, the Emergency Heart Failure Mortality Risk Grade, the EHMRG, which we will call the eMERGE, which for those of you who don't live and practice in Canada, that is what we call emergency departments in Canada, eMERGE. And then there's the MESSI score, M-E-E-S-S-I, which is the Spanish ED scale. Now, the first thing I like to do when using any decision tool is to go over the exclusion criteria used in developing the tools so that we don't apply the tools to the wrong patient. Dr. Adsema, what were the important exclusion criteria for these tools so that we know who not to apply the tools to?
These are patients on dialysis, palliative patients, patients with an altered mental status in the ED, or dementia. So these are pretty easy to remember because they're pretty common exclusion criteria for most studies. However, the Ottawa score had a couple extra exclusion criteria. And the way to kind of encapsulate these is there are patients that you wouldn't apply the score to anyway because it's so obvious that they're going to come in. So one of them was that their oxygen sat was less than 85%. Obviously, you don't need a score or a tool to tell you that they need to come in. A systolic pressure of less than 85, again, pretty obvious. The other one was a heart rate greater than 120. Those patients were not included. They were excluded.
That last one you said, a heart rate of 120. I mean, we have tons of patients who come in with a heart rate of more than 120, you know, just with a bit of anxiety who really aren't that sick. I'm actually just surprised about that one, that they excluded everyone with a heart rate over 120.
It's worth highlighting, and you might get a slightly healthier cohort in your study because of that. And you need to make sure you don't put patients who have a heart rate above that who might have a different outcome when you're using this tool.
Okay, we'll talk a little bit more about that when we talk about the Ottawa risk score in particular a little bit later in the podcast. I want to start with the lesser known risk score, which is the Spanish ED scale. Dr. Adsema, what's included in the Spanish ED heart failure scale? And do you think there's any role for using the Spanish ED heart failure scale in the emergency department?
So this was created by Oscar Miro and his group of emergency physicians and scientists in Spain. I know them, respect them. They're a great group. And this was published in Annals of Internal Medicine, which is a great journal. And it speaks to the rigor of their work that they managed to get it published in this journal. But that said, I don't use it because it includes the Barthel Index, which is a composite score of 10 ADLs, like bathing and dressing. You have to give a score for these things, walking, toileting. And that's a lot to go through when you're in the ED. And the patient may not be able to tell you how they function on a day-to-day basis with these ADLs because they're tachypneic and they're tired. And not surprisingly, the study had a lot of missing data in that variable, which speaks to how difficult it is to glean that kind of information in the ED setting. It also uses proBNP, and I also find it's a bit difficult in terms of KT. You can look up the score online. I Googled it, but it doesn't really explain what some of the variables mean. Like, what does low output symptoms exactly mean? I don't have time to pull the study when I'm working in the ED. I really want it to tell me exactly what I need to be looking for. So for that reason, I don't use it in the ED.
All right. So the Spanish ED score, or the MESSI score, the MEESSI score, that's out because basically it's too complex to calculate for busy ED docs, and it's quite subjective too, even though it's very predictive. So that leaves us with the Ottawa score and the eMERGE score. The components of the Ottawa score, which we'll have in the show notes, include historical features, vital signs, and labs. So in the history, there's previous intubation and previous stroke. For vital signs, there's the triage heart rate over 110, an oxygen saturation of less than 90, and a heart rate on a 3-minute walk test of more than 110. In the labs, there's an elevated troponin, ischemic changes on the ECG, a CO2 of more than 35, a BUN of more than 12, and a proBNP of more than 5,000. And they have a cutoff of 1 or 2 to recommend admission. The outcomes they looked at were serious adverse events, which included 30-day mortality or day 14 readmission, MI, or need for intubation or non-invasive positive pressure ventilation or a major procedure. So Dr. Lee, what were the results of the Ottawa heart failure score?
The Ottawa heart failure risk score at the lower end, the lowest possible score is 0. If you have a score of more than 1 and you have NT-proBNP available, the sensitivity was pretty good, 96%, but the specificity was quite low, about 14%. But you end up admitting about 88% of the patients, so you're admitting a lot of people. Without BNP, the sensitivity drops to about 92% and the specificity goes up a little bit more. If we use a slightly higher cutoff of more than 2, the sensitivity drops again and the specificity increases, but the admission rates start to fall. Sensitivity drops to 79.8% with BNP, and without BNP, it drops to 71%. So you end up admitting a lot of patients if you use a lower cutoff and you have BNP.
Okay, that's interesting because that 88% admission rate using the cutoff of 1 and the pro-BNP, those admission rates are very high. They're as high as the admission rates in the United States. And you could argue that maybe those admission rates are too high. Dr. Atsma, comments on that?
We get the sensitivity that we want to feel comfortable, that we're not missing anything when we discharge a patient, we're going to have to admit almost 90% of our patients, much like the rates in the U.S. And that's not what we want. We want to be able to decrease the admission rates so patients can sleep in their own beds, but do it safely with a tool that identifies the safe patients.
And Dr. Atsma, any comments about what was included and what was excluded in the Ottawa score?
So I think this is a great opportunity to address something that really bothers clinicians, and it did bother me before I went into science and research. But it's a truism of statistics that when you're trying to derive a tool and you get a set of variables like they have in this tool or in any of the other tools, together they predict very well whether or not you're going to have the outcome of interest. They can discriminate who's going to have it and who doesn't. And it's just that combination of variables together. And yes, you can add more, but it's not going to meaningfully increase the ability of the tool to discriminate between who's going to have a bad outcome and who isn't. And clinicians have a hard time accepting this, and I understand why. A good example would be Hasbled. All clinicians are like, where's the propensity for falls? I need to put in how many falls they've had in the last few months if I'm going to estimate what their bleeding risk is. But it won't add anything to the variables that are already in there. This is just how statistics work. And sometimes we clinician scientists, who are scientists also practice medicine, we push that variable in there just to make the clinicians happy, to give our tool face validity so they'll believe that it works. But it's really not adding anything. That's just the way statistics work. So it was a very long-winded way of saying that I don't think this tool is missing anything. It was derived and validated by a team that does really rigorous work. And if that's what the statistics came out with, it isn't missing anything. But one thing I will say is we define the exclusion criteria. It's very important to define the inclusion criteria because there's co-diagnoses, which are something to consider when we think about what's included. These co-diagnoses can be very important, like if it's AFib or GI bleed, because all of these tools are enrolling patients who have a primary ED diagnosis of heart failure, if you think that's the main diagnosis. But if you have someone with a GI bleed and then they get heart failure, that's not someone to apply any of these tools to because they're going to have a very different outcome and the tool wasn't meant to predict their outcomes. Same thing with someone who you think is primarily AFib and then they go into some heart failure or have some heart failure on top of it, they could have a very different outcome. So you definitely want to make sure you're applying these to the patients who have a primary ED diagnosis of heart failure.
I want to talk a little bit more about the co-diagnoses or the other diagnoses or the triggers and the causes of acute heart failure, because this is obviously going to affect how you risk stratify your patients and decide whether or not you're going to send them home. And sometimes we do that search satisficing thing where we make a diagnosis of heart failure and we just stop there because those patients who the cause of heart failure is just, you know, sodium indiscretion, they're going to be very different than the patients who have ischemia as a cause of their heart failure. Dr. Lee, could you just go through for us first the sort of benign common causes and triggers of heart failure, and then the not so benign ones that we really need to be on the lookout for and try and identify in the emergency department?
Right. So, you know, it's always a challenge to identify what's the precipitant of heart failure. Starting with the benign causes, you know, often the non-adherence to dietary or fluid restrictions is one. Often when you take a history from a patient, then the patient realizes that fruits, vegetables, soups, coffee, tea, milk, all constitute fluid. And the amount of fluid that should be consumed by heart failure patients within 24 hours is 1.5 to 2 liters. There's often an immediate realization that too much fluid has been consumed. The same goes for sodium intake. Another relatively benign cause might be considered to be medication non-adherence, which is often inadvertent. Patients might not be on the medications they're supposed to be on because it wasn't refilled, or they might be on medications that they shouldn't be on, like NSAIDs, which could exacerbate their heart failure. In this type of situation, taking the time to actually look at the pill bottles might be very instructive and might be able to help identify, you know, whether there was an adjustment to the Lasix dose or the furosemide dose.
You know, this really hits on the importance of giving really good discharge instructions, because I think many of us probably do not talk about something like maximum fluid intake in 24 hours and really go through that with patients, which, you know, that might be why some of these patients don't do well, is for very simple things, just sodium indiscretion, maximum fluid intake, you know, ensuring that they're actually taking their medications. And so I just want to underline how important these things are when we do send them home. Those discharge instructions are going to be really key. Okay, so that's some of the benign things with the underlying importance of how we discharge patients. What about the more sinister triggers or causes that can be associated with heart failure that we really need to identify in the emergency department?
Among the more serious causes, you know, right up there is ischemia. And ischemia in heart failure patients is often hard to detect. They don't present like an unstable angina patient. And, you know, some of the clues that there might be ischemia being active in an acute heart failure patient as a precipitant is even a slight elevation in troponin or ischemic changes on the 12-lead ECG, both which confer an increased risk of mortality. Infection is another major and important cause. And in addition to clues like a low-grade fever, you know, patients might have warm extremities because they're vasodilated. So that might be another potential clue. And then, you know, another important cause is arrhythmias. It can be pretty obvious that atrial fibrillation might be a causative factor in patients who are really tacky in the ER. But in patients with HFpEF who might have diastolic dysfunction, they can actually go into heart failure even though their heart rate's relatively controlled, less than 110, for example. And so the awareness of arrhythmias, particularly atrial fibrillation, is really important. But the, you know, despite our best efforts, about 30% of the time, we can't really identify what the specific precipitant is.
I just want to pick up on a couple of things you said there. You said that even a mildly elevated troponin confers a higher risk. Could you tell us a little bit more about that?
Yeah, so we found that a troponin on the fourth generation troponins that was above the upper limit of normal, even if it's slightly above the upper limit of normal and not in the MI range, actually increases risk. And for high sensitivity troponins, about three times higher than the 99th percentile, which is approximately 45, actually starts to increase the risk of mortality within 7 days.
Wow. So on the scale that we have, the troponin that we use, the cutoff for an MI is 100 and less than three is undetectable. So if it's anything over 45, we really should be worried about an increased mortality in that patient that has congestive heart failure, even if there's no ischemic changes or any evidence of ischemia that we can otherwise muster in the emergency department. And could you comment also on cardiorenal syndrome in terms of one of the associations or triggers of congestive heart failure?
Yeah, cardiorenal syndrome is really quite important because, you know, an elevation in creatinine, worsening in renal function in patients with heart failure is a very, very poor prognostic sign. Cardiorenal syndrome can be caused by worsening renal function. You know, alternatively, it can actually be caused by venous congestion, which can actually cause a presentation of rising creatinine in patients with acute heart failure. The way to differentiate that is that with diuresis, if it's venous congestion, often the creatinine improves. If the underlying cause of worsening renal function is renal in nature, with aggressive diuresis, the renal function will worsen. And so that's kind of one little tip that can help differentiate.
That's a great clinical pearl. I want to talk a little bit more about one of the things that I really like about the Ottawa score, which is the walk test, which I personally use quite a lot in the emergency department. You know, you get the patient to walk for a couple of minutes and check their oxygen saturation before and after. And I've been surprised at the number of patients who I think are safe to go home. And then I walk test them and they are not safe to go home because they desat to like 86% or something. Dr. Atsuma, what's your take on the walk test that is included in the Ottawa heart failure score?
I use it too. Well, really just only for patients who I'm sort of sitting on the fence and I want to reassure myself that they're not desaturating every time they go to the washroom when they go home. Those patients I use, and I must say I don't ask the nurses to walk them around for a full 3 minutes, which is what the Ottawa score stipulates, but they do walk around for a bit and I just make sure they're not desatting and their heart rate isn't going too high. Just an extra piece of information to add into context with everything else.
Fair enough. All right. And before we leave the Ottawa score, let's talk about the criticisms of the score. I mean, this was a really well-done study. Dr. Lee, any criticisms of the Ottawa heart failure score?
First of all, I'd like to reiterate, you know, the Ottawa group does, you know, pretty amazing research in the ED space. And I think the Ottawa Heart Failure score is great. However, there's a lot of exclusions even before you can actually be eligible to have the score calculated. If you've had symptoms of shortness of breath for more than 7 days, if you don't have chest x-ray evidence of heart failure, they weren't actually eligible to be included in the score.
And we all know that, you know, a normal chest x-ray does not rule out CHF, because up to 20 or 30% of patients with congestive heart failure will have no signs of congestive heart failure on their x-ray, right?
Absolutely. In addition to what Dr. Atzma mentioned earlier about the heart rate and the O2 sat restrictions, when you look at the patients who were included in the Ottawa Heart Failure Risk Score, if you look at the validation studies, the 30-day mortality rate in that group was 3.7%. But if you actually look at the 30-day mortality rate in some of our earlier prospective validation studies and also from the control arm of the COACH trial, the mortality rate at 30 days was about double that, 7%. So that's kind of a byproduct of excluding a lot of the patients who could potentially be higher risk that might not be eligible to have the score calculated. The other issues with the Ottawa Heart Failure Risk Score is that troponin, for example, should be in the MI range. And we discussed that even a slightly elevated troponin actually confers increased risk. And, you know, the lowest score, which was a score of 0, actually still conferred a 14-day event rate of about between 2 and 3%. And so, you know, one wonders, is that enough, low enough a score to discharge the patient from the ED?
They actually had two scores, one with a BNP and one without a BNP, because they recognize that not everyone has a BNP. But I do want to talk a little bit more about BNP, because on the Journal Jam podcast that we did a few years back, we concluded from that that the evidence for BNP actually is not very good at all. We know that the BNP is affected by age, by kidney disease, by obesity, by hypertension, by coronary disease, by atrial fibrillation, by chronic respiratory disease. And I do see this used more often these days than when we looked at the data a few years ago. Dr. Atzma, what's your take on the use of BNP in your workup of the patient with suspected heart failure?
Well, I can get a BNP in a timely way in my ED, so I do get it for certain patients. And to be clear, I'm just putting it into context with all of the clinical data that I've already amassed about the patient. And I use it to help me when it's very, very low, like a BNP less than 100. And I can reassure myself that I'm not missing heart failure and sending a patient home who really needs to be admitted. And the only other time it's helpful is when it's really high into the thousands. And hopefully I didn't really need that confirmation anyway, based on my clinical information. So I don't get it for every patient by any means, but there are certain patients where I will get it.
Okay. And Dr. Lee, your take on BNP?
The BNP is in the emergency department. I think it's useful if you're trying to specifically differentiate heart failure from some other cause of shortness of breath like COPD. But even in the breathing not properly trial, which was actually using BNP to compare the two, the gold standard was the clinical exam and the medical record. So I don't think BNP needs to be done in every emergency department.
A word from our sponsor, Metricade, the experts on scheduling systems. Since 2015, I've been using Metricade, the incredible self-scheduling system that has made my life and the lives of my colleagues so much easier. Metricade can really help minimize the drawbacks of shift work we all know so well by not only ensuring equitable distribution of shifts, but also integrating circadian rhythm-friendly recovery time into their algorithms. They minimize my sleep deprivation, which allows me to be a better EM doc on shift. I can take better care of my patients and still have energy left after my shifts to enjoy other aspects of my life. Check out metricade.com/emcases for more details on how this awesome scheduling system works. Okay, so let's move on from the Ottawa score to the other Canadian score. That's the EMERGE score, or the EHMRG score. The score looked at 7 and 30-day mortality in heart failure patients in the ED. Given that there are many flavors of heart failure, diastolic, systolic, left-sided, right-sided, scape, etc., and that we do miss the diagnosis quite often, and sometimes there's multiple acute diagnoses going on, it makes coming up with a decision tool very difficult, and it drives home the importance of getting a good definition of heart failure. So let's just start with that, actually, Dr. Lee. In the study, how did you define heart failure, and why did you define it that way?
So we used three criteria to help us define heart failure. The first was the Framingham heart failure criteria, which combines numerous physical exam features, as was discussed earlier in the podcast. The second part of the definition was we used the final diagnosis that takes into account all of the information from the hospital stay or the eMERGE stay, whether the final diagnosis was heart failure. We've shown in some of our earlier studies that this final diagnosis of heart failure is actually quite predictive, 90% predictive for the diagnosis of heart failure. And then finally, we used BNP. If the BNP was very low and not suggestive of heart failure, those patients were excluded. We used these multiple criteria to allow us to balance having a high specificity, including heart failure patients in the cohort, while being pragmatic and trying to be as inclusive as possible.
Okay, yeah. I do like studies that have a pragmatic definition because we are pragmatists in EM cases. All right. Now, the components of the eMERGE score, like the Ottawa score, include historical features, vitals, and labs. So again, these will be in the show notes, but here they are just for a flavor. So for history, there's age, there's transportation to the ED via EMS, there's active cancer, there's interestingly taking metalazone, and then the vital signs, there's the triage systolic blood pressure, there's the heart rate and oxygen saturation, and then for labs, there's troponin elevation, there's creatinine elevation, and then there's an abnormality in the potassium. And then finally, on ECG, there's a few things. There's any ST depression or bundle branch block or LVH with strain or paced rhythm. Now, before we dive into analyzing the eMERGE score, I think it's really interesting that features like active cancer and bundle branch block or LVH with strain are high-risk features. I wouldn't have necessarily thought that those are particularly high risk. Dr. Atsuma, do you have any comments about what was included in the score and what was excluded, in particular the cancer and all those ECG findings? And then finally, the one of patients taking metalazone. Can you just comment about the reasoning behind why those were included in the score?
So those actually make good clinical sense to me, in part because I've had similar findings when looking at AFib patients and their ECGs. So with AFib patients, probably similarly, all of these ECG findings like a bundle branch block or a paced rhythm, even strain pattern, they're signs of electrical pathways that have been infiltrated by collagen and fibrosis. They're just not as healthy a heart as a heart that has a nice strip without these findings. So for me, it actually wasn't that surprising that a bundle branch block or paced rhythm is high risk for bad outcomes because I found that with AFib patients as well. Metalazone use, as far as I know, is associated with diuretic resistance, and that definitely is associated with a higher mortality.
And we think that cancer could contribute to a higher risk in heart failure because of potentially the cardiotoxic effects of chemotherapy, fluid shifts, and then the epiphenomena associated with cancer itself, such as a hypercoagulability, as well as immunosuppression. So all of those things increase the mortality risk in heart failure patients. In addition to that, we found that blood pressure was quite an important indicator. If you had lower systolic blood pressure, there was a significantly increased risk of mortality. And we think that that is due to LV ejection fraction, that if you have poor LV ejection fraction, you are not able to mount a systolic blood pressure response. High heart rate, we think, reflects a higher adrenergic tone. High creatinine is an important indicator of the cardiorenal syndrome. Renal function is really, really important as a prognostic factor in patients with heart failure. And then to add to Dr. Atsuma's comments about the bundle branch block, we also think that evidence of bundle branch block is also evidence for worsening LV systolic function as well. So it's also maybe a proxy indicator for LV ejection fraction. And then we talked about troponin earlier as well, an important prognostic factor.
Great. So all of these things, whether you're going to use this tool every day in your practice or not, they're really good things to consider. So a lower systolic blood pressure is a bad prognostic factor. A higher heart rate is a bad prognostic factor. Poor renal function is a bad prognostic factor. Active cancer, a slightly elevated troponin, doesn't have to be huge, but even just a troponin of 45 if you're using the high sensitivity one with a cutoff of 100 for an MI. And use of metalazone. So those are really good ones to remember, again, whether you're using the tool or not. One of the noteworthy things about the eMERGE studies that I found is that in the validation studies, physicians overestimated the risk in low-risk patients and underestimated the risk in high-risk patients. So in other words, they were admitting patients who were low enough risk to go home, and they were sending home patients who were at high risk, which obviously is not a good thing to do. So Dr. Lee, could you just comment on how we should use this information in our decision-making?
Yeah, actually, just to provide a little bit of background on that validation study, we actually did this because we spoke to our eMERGE colleagues who said, oh, I think I'm pretty good at determining whether my patient with heart failure is high risk or not. And so that was really the motivation for doing the study. And what we found was that when you compared the physician's assessment using the eyeball of the risk of the patient, we called this the physician estimated risk. When you compared the physician estimated risk with the eMERGE score, what we found was that lower risk patients, doctors tended to overestimate risk, when in fact, the eMERGE score would indicate that they're lower risk. Concerningly, in the highest risk decile, patients who were really high risk, doctors tended to underestimate their risk. And so we think this explains some of our earlier observations where a lot of lower risk patients were being admitted to hospital when they could potentially go home. And concerningly, some really high risk patients were being discharged home, even though they were being seen by the physician in the eMERGE. You know, physician estimated risk is actually not too bad. When we develop models, predictive models, we use something called discrimination, where a value of 1.0 on this discriminative index, what we call the C index, is a perfect test. And a value of 0.5 means that it's no better than a coin flip. Physician estimated risk, that's the physician's estimate, their gestalt estimate, actually was not too bad. The C statistic was 0.7. But when you use the eMERGE score, the C statistic was 0.82. So we think this explains why doctors, when they use their physician estimated risk, their gestalt, to make decisions, they're potentially fallible. Sometimes we might send home patients who are really high risk who potentially shouldn't go home.
So the bottom line there is that the tool is better than physician gestalt.
Yes, we think that the tool is better than physician gestalt. The tool shouldn't dictate what should be done with the patient, but the tool should be used to assist and guide the clinicians to make their best clinical judgment.
Absolutely, just like any tool. That's the eMERGE score and the validation of the eMERGE score. There was a second trial called the COACH trial, also a Canadian study, that looked at the question of whether or not the use of the eMERGE score coupled with a rapid follow-up in an outpatient cardiology clinic would affect outcomes of acute heart failure patients. Could you just tell us a little bit about the methods and the results of the COACH trial?
So the COACH trial was a pragmatic randomized trial where we tested our intervention, which is comprised of two elements. The first element was using the eMERGE 7 and 30-day risk algorithm to risk stratify patients. The second element was a rapid follow-up clinic where lower risk patients could be discharged to either after direct discharge from the ED or after a short length of stay in the hospital of 3 days or less. The primary outcome of the trial was death or cardiovascular hospitalization. And this was an outcome where we had a patient advisory panel who advised us on what outcomes were important to them. And they chose this outcome as the primary outcome of the trial.
Okay, just to clarify there, you said 3 days of admission. Do you mean a short stay unit?
Yes. So in the intervention, in the design of the COACH trial, patients who were low risk or low intermediate risk, they could either be discharged directly from the ED to home, or they could be admitted for a short length of stay, which is 3 days or less, in hospital if there was doubt about whether they could go home or not. Those patients who were discharged directly from the ED or were discharged after a short length of stay were then eligible to be followed up in a rapid outpatient follow-up clinic where they would be seen by nurse practitioners and the clinic would be supervised by a cardiologist. So that was the primary intervention of the trial. The control group of the trial was usual care with no access to the risk score and no rapid follow-up clinic.
So that's a bit about how the COACH trial was designed. Could you just tell us the results of the COACH trial?
The primary result of the trial at 30 days showed a significant reduction in the primary composite outcome of death or cardiovascular hospitalization. The relative risk reduction was 12% at 30 days. There was a slight trend to a reduction in mortality, but this was not statistically significant. There were significant reductions in cardiovascular hospitalization, which was reduced by about 15%. And this was largely driven by a reduction in heart failure hospitalizations, which were reduced by 19%.
So I just want to highlight there that the mortality rate, when it was looked at alone, was not reduced, but what was reduced was a composite of mortality and readmission, which I understand is a common way of measuring things in cardiology trials. Yeah.
It's pretty common in cardiology trials now because we've recognized that when patients are repeatedly hospitalized, it's actually associated with worse prognosis every time they're hospitalized. And so it's often used as a composite outcome. In our particular trial, our trial was advised by a patient advisory panel, as mentioned earlier. And these were patients with heart failure, with lived experience, and they chose this outcome as being important to them. And so it became the primary composite outcome of the COACH trial.
Okay, fair enough. So what do you think the sort of key take-home points from the COACH trial, practical take-homes that people can use on their next shift?
I think the first take-home message is that the eMERGE risk score is a pretty valid risk score in risk stratifying patients in the emergency department. In our earlier studies, we found that the risk of 7-day mortality in the lowest two quintiles was 0%, and the risk of 30-day death in the lowest quintile was 0%. This means that the sensitivity of the score was 100% for identifying low-risk patients who could potentially go home or be discharged early. So the risk score works pretty well. The second take-home message is this rapid heart failure clinic where patients can receive care after they've been discharged. And we think it's important because, you know, this is where we would want to up-titrate guideline-directed medications, make sure they're on the appropriate dose of diuretic, make sure they're getting an echocardiogram to assess their LV function, evaluate their electrolytes and creatinine while we're giving them therapy, and evaluate for any underlying causes of heart failure as well. So a rapid follow-up in an outpatient clinic setting is a pretty important aspect of good follow-up care for heart failure. And the third take-home point is that when we combine risk stratification using the eMERGE and rapid follow-up care, we can improve clinical outcomes with a reduction in the composite of death or cardiovascular hospitalizations. This was reduced by 12% at 30 days, which was the primary outcome of the COACH trial.
Sounds pretty good. Dr. Atsuma, what's your take on the eMERGE score? Advantages, disadvantages, criticisms? Are you going to use it in your practice?
Yes, to the latter. I am going to use it in my practice. I think it's a really good tool from a methodological perspective. It's been rigorously derived, then prospectively validated on a separate cohort, so temporal validation as well. And then the final step, which very few tools have, it's been evaluated in an implementation trial. So that is the pinnacle of tool development. And that's what I look for when I'm actually going to use something in clinical practice and put myself on the line and put my patients' decisions on the line. I also really like that it was compared to physician estimate of risk, because the vast majority of tools that are out there, sure, they work and they have a pretty good C statistic or discriminative ability, I should say. But how do we know that's any better than what we're doing now as eMERGE physicians, just doing our practice? And very few tools do that. And this tool, along with the Ottawa score, does do that. So that's another big strength. And I also like that it's a pragmatic trial. They put this tool and the follow-up in the hands of real emergency physicians who could make decisions based on what they got. They didn't automatically admit, or if the score was such and such, they decided themselves, which is how it's going to be used in real practice. As far as criticisms or disadvantages, one issue with the RCT is that the decision isn't just admit or discharge, which for most of us in the emergency department is exactly what it is. It could be, yes, discharge directly from the ED, or they could come in to these OBS units or really just up to 3 days in hospital. And so I don't know how much of these good results were driven by patients who were admitted and got better care for that couple of days, because I don't really, I mean, I do have that option, and I guess I need to keep that in mind. But in general, I'm deciding, you know, admit or discharge as opposed to admit for a couple of days. And the other issue is this early follow-up with a heart failure clinic. I think from an equity lens, it's a wonderful thing, because if you have a nurse practitioner running this clinic with sort of a checkbox of all the goal-directed medical therapy and stuff they're supposed to get, great. That can be implemented in rural areas, and they can use Zoom to report to the cardiologist in the area, and everyone can get access to that, which is wonderful. But I also want to know, how quickly do I need to get this? And what does my hospital need to set up? How much do I advocate for a clinic within 3 days, which is what the goal was in COACH, but in reality, I think it was a bit longer. So do they need to be seen within 7 days such that I can emulate these results?
When we designed the trial, we took the advice of the emergency physicians who wanted to be able to admit patients who were lower risk if they were concerned about sending the patient home. So admitting the patient for a short length of stay was a viable option for low or low intermediate risk patients, just because some emergency physicians didn't want to send the patients home directly. When we looked at the patients who were admitted in this group, though, the length of stay was 1 day primarily. So a lot of them were being discharged the very next day. And not all hospitals had an observation unit. This might support that having an observation might be useful, because a lot of times for patients, you know, that are lower risk, where the emerge physician's still not sure, they might benefit from admission to an observation unit. For those who are admitted for up to 3 days, we think it's still a win, because the median length of stay in hospital is approximately 6 to 7 days in Ontario. And so if we can shorten the length of stay from 6 to 7 days to less than 3 days, we think that's still a bit of a win. In terms of the follow-up, our aim was to have everyone seen within 3 business days. But as was mentioned, it's a pragmatic trial. Things didn't work out exactly the way we wanted. But most of the patients were seen within 1 week. When we looked at the data of were there any events that occurred from the time that they were discharged from the hospital or the ED until they could be seen in clinic, there were 0 deaths. So it was pretty safe, even when the follow-up is stretched out to about 7 days. In terms of the clinic, some of the participating hospitals did not have heart failure clinics. We actually had a standard work approach where the clinics could use a checklist to make sure that they hit all of the major post-discharge points that indicate higher quality of heart failure care. So was an echocardiogram done? Were medications reviewed? Were electrolytes and creatinine inject? You know, all of these things formed a checklist that the clinic could use to ensure that they were providing, you know, pretty good high quality care for patients who were discharged from the ED. And so we hope that, you know, even in hospitals where there's no advanced heart failure clinic, that they could use the checklist and use this as a potential approach, perhaps by telemedicine with cardiology centers to ensure that the patient's getting pretty good care.
I think one of my take homes after reading the COACH trial and listening to you is that we really need hospital administration to come together, cardiology or internal medicine and emergency department, and work together as one team to try and streamline this whole process so we can get better outcomes for these patients. And we can all agree when they get a call from us in the ED how that's going to be managed, and we can all support the same aim.
Hear, hear. And now a word from one of our sponsors, EZ Recess, the resuscitation assistant. Did you know that EZ Recess is brought to you by a nonprofit organization dedicated to improving care in resuscitation? This means that every dollar from your subscription goes to improving EZ Recess. But not only that, thanks to your contributions, EZ Recess can be made affordable for healthcare workers in developing countries so that they can also deliver the best care possible to their patients. If you want to help them in their mission, download EZ Recess and use promo code EMCases to get your first 2 months free, or visit easyrecess.com/EMCases for more details. So suffice to say that this was a very well done large study with the big advantage that it compared physician gestalt to the tool and found that the tool was better, and that we should pay attention to the individual components of the score because they do seem somewhat predictive. And maybe the score will encourage us to think a bit more carefully about disposition in these patients, and also to advocate for observation units at our hospitals, or at least to have follow-up within 7 days in an internal medicine clinic or a cardiology clinic, which, as you say, can be led by an RN and done by telemedicine, so it doesn't have to be too complicated. All right, none of the disposition decision scales we've looked at incorporate point-of-care ultrasound, POCUS. Yet, there's an argument to be made that POCUS in the hands of a skilled operator is way more accurate at both diagnosis and should probably be used to help make disposition decisions as well. We've already discussed the utility of BNP for diagnosis and disposition, which remains controversial, and we know that X-ray is unreliable. Again, 20% of chest X-rays in patients with acute heart failure show no findings of heart failure at all. And POCUS can be used to look at B-lines. It can be used to look at IVC size and collapsibility, JVD, pleural effusions, and LV end diastolic dimension, and these all help with the diagnosis. In addition, you can approximate the ejection fraction to help you with risk stratification and disposition. I invited Dr. Ian Chernoff, an EM veteran and POCUS educator, to give us his take on the utility of POCUS in the diagnosis, risk stratification, and disposition of heart failure. Here's Dr. Chernoff.
Thanks so much for including me in this conversation, Anton. Heart failure evaluation is tailor-made for point-of-care ultrasound, as there is so much POCUS that is of value in the assessment of these patients. And the best news about POCUS in heart failure is that the elements of POCUS that are of greatest value in heart failure are also those that are easiest to learn. So I think that all emergency physicians have the ability to add elements of point-of-care ultrasound to their assessment of patients with heart failure, and in so doing, greatly improve the care that they provide to them. Where point-of-care ultrasound really shines in heart failure is diagnostically. The majority of the diagnostic yield from POCUS in heart failure comes from lung ultrasound alone. In general, the best POCUS exams are those that are fast and easy to obtain, easy to interpret, and significantly impact patient care. And lung ultrasound in heart failure ticks all of those boxes. In every single study that has compared the two, lung ultrasound performs chest X-ray plus or minus BNP. Highlighting this, in a 2019 Italian ED randomized controlled trial that compared the two head-to-head, clinical workup plus lung ultrasound produced a whopping positive likelihood ratio of 20.9 and negative likelihood ratio of 0.07 for the diagnosis of acute heart failure compared to likelihood ratios of 8.0 and 0.17 for clinical workup plus chest X-ray BNP. And the time to diagnosis was 5 minutes for lung ultrasound versus 104.5 minutes for chest X-ray plus BNP. In addition, a 2015 multi-center prospective study by Pavetta showed that following clinical evaluation with physical exam, EKG, and blood gases, using lung ultrasound produced a positive likelihood ratio of 14.1 and negative likelihood ratio of 0.1 for the diagnosis of heart failure, versus likelihood ratios of 3.9 and 0.4 for chest X-ray. In addition, the use of lung ultrasound in this study led to a change in diagnosis in 19%, or 1 out of every 5 patients. And a 2014 systematic review and meta-analysis showed lung ultrasound provided a pooled positive likelihood ratio of 12.4 and negative likelihood ratio of 0.06 for the diagnosis of heart failure. Furthermore, in a 2022 ACEP clinical policy statement on the evaluation and management of heart failure in the ED, the diagnostic use of lung ultrasound in acute heart failure was endorsed as a level B recommendation. Lung ultrasound was the single diagnostic test for heart failure that there was adequate evidence for ACEP to include in this clinical policy statement. That same policy statement also examined the evidence for the therapeutic use of both nitrates and diuresis in acute heart failure, two therapies that we all hold as sacred, and found it was only sufficient to justify level C recommendations for their use. Fortunately, lung ultrasound has evolved to a point where any medical provider can rapidly and easily use lung ultrasound to aid in the diagnosis of acute heart failure. How rapidly and how easily? A positive lung ultrasound for heart failure is defined by the presence of at least 3 B lines in 2 bilateral lung zones. We also know that B lines first appear in the bases of the lungs, then progress to involve the upper lungs as heart failure worsens. So a 2019 study asked if we could just look at the lower lung zones alone with lung ultrasound to diagnose heart failure. They compared the diagnostic yield of a 2-lung zone protocol that looked at just the lower lungs through a single probe position on either side of the chest to a 4-lung zone protocol that examined both the upper and lower lungs bilaterally. They defined a positive lung ultrasound as either greater than 3 B lines per lung zone or a pleural effusion bilaterally. The lower lungs were examined by placing the probes laterally in each 5th intercostal space in the mid-axillary lines. The upper lung zones by placing a probe anteriorly in each 2nd intercostal space in the mid-clavicular lines. They found that looking at the lateral zones alone provided a sensitivity of 100% and a specificity of 83% for the diagnosis of acute heart failure. So they showed that examining the lateral zones alone with lung ultrasound is enough to diagnose acute heart failure. Not only that, they showed that this could be accomplished within 30 seconds. And how much pre-existing ultrasound skill do you need to be able to use lung ultrasound to diagnose heart failure? I would say little to none. A 2018 paper showed that lung ultrasound for heart failure could be competently done by junior medical students with little ultrasound experience and by nurses on cardiology wards. Even more impressively, a 2021 paper examined the ability of patients with heart failure to perform lung ultrasound on themselves to monitor the number of B lines at home. The patients were provided with a 15-minute instructional video on 4-zone lung ultrasound, then shown how to perform the exam on themselves with a handheld butterfly ultrasound probe and an iPad. They were sent home, and their images were subsequently uploaded to a cloud to be interpreted by emergency physicians. How successful were these patients in performing lung ultrasound? 85% of the images they produced were adequate for interpretation, and 98% of these patients said they felt comfortable performing the technique. So if lung ultrasound can be learned by lay people, there truly should be little barrier to emergency doctors giving it a try. In doing lung ultrasound for heart failure, looking bilaterally in the 5th intercostal space, mid-axillary line, should be adequate to make the diagnosis, and this should easily be able to be achieved in well under a minute. B lines change very dynamically as heart failure worsens or improves. In acute heart failure, the number of B lines will decrease within 3 hours of initiation of treatment, such as giving a diuretic intravenously. B lines can be used to monitor response to therapy and have prognostic value. In one study, a high residual number of B lines at discharge identified patients with a 5-fold greater risk for heart failure, readmission, or death. In another conducted in outpatient heart failure clinics, high numbers of B lines were associated with a nearly 4-fold increased risk of 6-month heart failure, rehospitalization, or death. Nothing is perfect, though, including lung ultrasound for heart failure. There are entities other than heart failure that can produce diffuse pulmonary B lines, such as ARDS, diffuse pneumonia, or pulmonary fibrosis. And in a small proportion of patients with heart failure, there will be no B lines to be found. Lung ultrasound is not a standalone test for heart failure, just like anything else in medicine, but a data point that needs to be incorporated into the rest of the patient's presentation. And if the diagnosis remains unclear after lung ultrasound, there is much more that can be done with POCUS to help determine whether a patient is in heart failure. In keeping with the theme of easy to perform POCUS applications that are high yield, the next task for POCUS after looking at the lungs is to look at their JVP. As was mentioned earlier in the podcast, the JVP undeniably provides useful information on heart failure, but also is frequently difficult to accurately identify in physical exam, regardless of the expertise of the examiner. With ultrasound, the height of the JVP can be directly visualized every time. There have been numerous ways of examining the JVP with ultrasound that have been described, but the one that I find the easiest was recently described in an article in the Annals of Internal Medicine. The patient's bed is inclined at 45 degrees, and a high-frequency ultrasound probe is placed over the sternocleidomastoid muscle just above the clavicle to identify the carotid artery and internal jugular vein in cross-section. The probe is then slid cranially until the IJ is of smaller diameter than the carotid throughout the respiratory cycle, and where the probe is positioned on the neck to achieve this is the height of the JVP. This study was performed on patients who were undergoing previously planned right heart catheterizations, so they were able to assess how their ultrasound JVP correlated with right atrial pressures. They found that it correlated well with an area under the curve of 0.84. In a 2018 article in the Journal of the American Heart Association, they showed that ultrasound examination of the JVP had prognostic value. Patients whose ultrasound JVP had normalized at discharge had a 91% positive predictive value for avoiding 30-day readmission. Similar to lung ultrasound for heart failure, one of the main selling points for ultrasound of the JVP is its ease of use, and I think that it is very underutilized. In many ways, I think that the discussion about using POCUS in the ER for heart failure should stop here, with two quick bedside tests that are easy to do, easy to interpret, and provide really useful clinical information. But I did want to go on to discuss other POCUS tools that can help with the diagnosis and treatment of heart failure in the ER. Ultrasound of the IVC is another exam that has been incorporated into numerous POCUS protocols to evaluate patients for heart failure. It's not quite as easy as looking at the lungs or JVP with ultrasound, but is of a similar value of difficulty to doing a subcostal view of the heart and is obtained through the same window, so should be within the skill set of most emergency doctors. But the same patient factors that can lead to difficulty in obtaining a subcostal view of the heart, obesity and bowel gas, can similarly impede your ability to visualize the IVC. Similar to the JVP, the IVC diameter correlates with right atrial pressures. So, does looking at the IVC with ultrasound add anything to looking at the JVP? There have been few studies that have compared the two in heart failure, but my guess is that in the majority of the time, maybe not. However, a 2023 study showed that in patients hospitalized with heart failure exacerbations, those with reduced ejection fraction were more likely to have elevated JVP than those with preserved ejection fraction, whereas IVC performed the same in both the reduced and preserved EF groups. This study is amongst others to show that IVC also has prognostic value in heart failure. Patients with an IVC over 2.07 centimeters on their inpatient echoes had a significantly elevated risk of heart failure rehospitalization within the next year. What about the heart itself? Is being able to estimate an ejection fraction also a key skill for emergency physicians to possess to evaluate patients in the ER with heart failure? To determine why they are in heart failure, especially if it is a new or surprising diagnosis, knowing how to do a focused echo exam with parasternal long and short axis views, apical four-chamber and subcostal views can obviously be invaluable. Maybe they have a new viral cardiomyopathy with markedly reduced ejection fraction leading to their heart failure, or maybe they have torrential mitral regurgitation. However, to determine if they are in heart failure, being able to estimate the ejection fraction has its limitations. First, as 50% of all heart failure has a preserved ejection fraction, focusing on the EF alone is going to miss all of those patients. Second, even if the EF is reduced, this may be a chronic finding and doesn't necessarily mean that the cause of the patient's presentation is acute heart failure. However, regardless of whether a patient presenting an acute heart failure has a reduced or a preserved EF, a common pathway to pulmonary edema developing both groups is the development of increased left atrial pressures. So focused heart protocol that allows for the evaluation of left atrial pressures should be more sensitive for diagnosing acute heart failure than protocols that evaluate ejection fraction alone. However, being able to evaluate left atrial pressures requires some knowledge of how to perform diastolic measurements. And admittedly, learning how to do this might not be the highest educational priority for many emergency physicians. However, if you're an emergency physician whose ultrasound skills are such that you already feel comfortable with lung ultrasound, JVP and IVC assessment, and are able to reliably generate all the basic views of the heart, including an apical four-chamber view, venturing into diastology may be a great place to spread your wings. A 2017 study developed a rapid cardiothoracic ultrasound protocol for the diagnosis of heart failure in the ED. This protocol involved doing four-zone lung ultrasound plus measuring left atrial pressure using an E to E prime ratio. An E to E prime ratio involves doing two separate pulse wave Doppler measurements via an apical four-chamber view. The investigator in the study, admittedly an experienced one, was able to do a four-zone lung ultrasound plus generate an E to E prime ratio within 3 minutes. And this protocol had a sensitivity of 100% and specificity of 95.8% for the diagnosis of acute heart failure. The last thing that I wanted to touch on was the evaluation of venous congestion with point-of-care ultrasound. Dr. Lee talked about the dilemma of renal venous congestion and heart failure management and cardiorenal syndrome. When the creatinine begins to climb in patients with heart failure that are being managed with diuretics, the knee-jerk way of thinking of this previously has been that these patients might be receiving too much diuresis, are too dry, and their kidneys aren't seeing enough fluid. However, we now know that this is not always the case, and it may be that their declining renal function is instead due to renal venous congestion from undertreated heart failure. Such patients need more diuresis to decongest their kidneys and improve their kidney function, not less. Dr. Lee mentioned that one way to show if renal venous congestion is the cause of a rising creatinine in cardiorenal syndrome is to be more aggressive with the diuresis of these patients. And in those in whom renal venous congestion is the underlying cause, their creatinine will begin to improve with such therapy. POCUS also provides a mechanism for evaluating venous congestion in heart failure patients through a protocol called VEXUS, or the Venous Excess Ultrasound Score. VEXUS is relatively new and reasonably complicated, but it has been met with relatively wild enthusiasm amongst critical care, nephrology, and emergency medicine POCUS enthusiasts for the promise it seems to hold for better evaluating the overall fluid status of a patient with ultrasound. So in addition to its use in heart failure, perhaps VEXUS will be able to guide fluid management decisions in resuscitation, for instance. And although it may not yet be within the reach of the average emergency physician, I think VEXUS is something that we're all going to hear more and more about over time. And as it pertains to the matter of hand, the use of VEXUS was shown by a 2023 Spanish study to potentially yield important prognostic information in the management of patients with heart failure. This was a small study, but of a sick population, 14% of whom died within the course of the hospital stay and 26% within 90 days. This study showed that patients with higher levels of venous congestion at admission documented by VEXUS had significantly higher rates of inpatient mortality. For instance, a severely abnormal renous VEXUS pattern predicted inpatient mortality with a sensitivity of 90%, specificity of 81%, positive predictive value of 43%, and negative predictive value of 98%. Furthermore, when these patients had a VEXUS exam repeated in an outpatient clinic and follow-up, the severely abnormal renous VEXUS pattern predicted need for heart failure readmission with a sensitivity of 92% and a specificity of 67%. And a distended IVC and outpatient follow-up also predicted need for readmission. To sum up, the test that has the single best characteristics for the diagnosis of heart failure, including everything that has been discussed in this podcast, POCUS or otherwise, is lung ultrasound. As a starting point for emergency physicians who want to incorporate POCUS into their evaluation of heart failure, simply taking 30 seconds to look bilaterally in their fifth intercostal spaces, mid-axillary lines for B lines, is going to markedly improve your diagnostic accuracy for heart failure. And if you take an additional minute or two to look at their JVP with ultrasound, you get even more diagnostic clarity. Particularly for patients with new diagnoses of heart failure, there are simple ways of evaluating the ejection fraction with POCUS that can produce a more complete picture of what has led the patient in front of you with heart failure to decompensate. Lastly, the number of B lines found on lung ultrasound, a persistently elevated JVP or distended IVC, and the demonstration of higher grades of venous congestion with VEXAS have all been shown to have prognostic value in heart failure patients. And it seems very likely that we will see the inclusion of many of these POCUS measures in future heart failure scores.
All right, so that was Dr. Chernoff on the value of POCUS in the diagnosis, risk stratification, and disposition of heart failure. Dr. Atzma, any comments about POCUS in terms of these three things?
I think it's been shown to be a great tool. You know, just from a statistical perspective, if you wanted to incorporate that with something like eMERGE, you would actually have to go back and do that study all over again from the beginning in order to be rigorous about it.
All right. So who knows? Maybe in a decade, Dr. Lee will have results of the eMERGE plus POCUS trial.
I'm happy to come back in a decade.
All right. Great. Now, before we get into the home stretch of the podcast, just a quick plug for the online International EM Cases Summit, November 21st to 23rd. We've got Jesse McLaren's Heart course for ECG interpretation for those of you who live in North America and for those who live in Australia and New Zealand. We've got Sarah Fooey's virtual recess room where you get to do simulations with expert individualized coaching from master debriefers like Andrew Petrosoniak, for example. We've got symposiums on ED flow to help you not only with your individual patient flow numbers, but to help your entire ED flow better. And we also have a symposium on rural EM for all you folks who practice in small or remote communities. We have an ebook summarizing all the talks of your favorite EM cases guest experts. That's included. Tickets are moving fast and are available through emcasesummit.com. So that's emcasesummit, all one word, .com. Hope to see you all there. Let's say our listeners do decide that they want to use the eMERGE score in their practice. Dr. Lee, how would you suggest we best implement the use of the score in EDs? You know, it's one thing to just talk about the score, but it's another to actually have it used in regular practice.
I think the best way to implement the use of the score is to have the eMERGE score be automatically calculated by the hospital information system. And so, for example, Epic can be programmed such that the code can actually pull all of the variables and automatically calculate the eMERGE score for you without any physician entering any data. And before they actually come and see the patient, the eMERGE score will be there at their fingertips to help them make a decision. Now, for those hospitals that do not have access to advanced health information systems, the data would have to be entered manually. And in that particular case, you would go to the website. There is the eMERGE 7-day score is available on MDCalc, but one caveat is that MDCalc does not have the 30-day score. And if one wants to access both the 7 and 30-day score that we use in the COACH trial, one would have to go to the COACH calculator, which is available at the at our website that will be in the show notes. Once all of the labs are back, it's actually quite simple to enter the data. It should take about less than a minute to be able to enter the data and calculate the score.
Fantastic. All right. So thank you both so much for your expertise on this topic. I hope that this podcast gave our listeners a chance to reflect a bit, to reflect on how we come to a diagnosis of acute heart failure in the ED and how we make disposition decisions, to realize that we can do better. I think if we all understand a bit more about the accuracy and test characteristics for the various clinical factors in the diagnosis of heart failure, if we think a bit more about using and improving our skills of POCUS, if we take into account all those triggers and co-diagnoses, if we do a better job when discharging our patients with our discharge instructions, and we consider implementing the decision tools and rapid outpatient follow-up, we could improve outcomes for our patients with heart failure worldwide. So thank you very much for your contributions.
Thank you very much, Dr. Hellman.
My pleasure.